From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. When someone loses a job, the struggles that follow begin but often don't end with money. Unemployment can change the entire dynamic of a family. As part of our series, The Road Back to Work, we've been following a couple whose relationship has been dominated by the search for work. NPR's Tamara Keith gives us this update on the Barfields.
Brian and Jennifer Barfield have been married for 7 months now, and they've never really known normal, at least not in the job department. They met at a networking group for unemployed professionals in St. Louis. They came from different backgrounds, Brian in manufacturing, Jennifer, an IT professional.
Blessings come out of the tough times. I wouldn't have met Brian. Our paths would never have crossed, I'm sure, if we weren't both unemployed.
For part of their courtship, Brian had a job, but it didn't last.
And then, of course, they let him go right after our honeymoon, which was a stay-home honeymoon. So we haven't even had a honeymoon. We're hoping to have a honeymoon within, I don't know, the first 2 years of marriage.
Living on unemployment and early withdrawals from Jennifer's 401k, the Barfields haven't been able to entertain the idea of a tropical vacation or even the occasional fancy dinner. For the Barfields, date night is hopping in the car and taking a drive around St. Louis.
If you want, we can go to that area on Lindbergh and watch the planes go by. See, we know all kinds of ways to entertain us for free, except for a little bit of gas money, I suppose.
At times, the frustration of both being unemployed puts stress on their marriage. Brian Barfield knows the havoc unemployment can wreak on a marriage. His first one ended after he initially became unemployed in 2007.
We lost a house, and I got divorced. The kids went and lived with their mother.
His daughters are both in college now. Back in February, Brian got a part-time weekend position that he hoped would be more regular, but it never really panned out. Meanwhile, the clock was ticking on Jennifer's unemployment benefits. And then a breakthrough.
This is Jennifer Barfield. It is Monday, March 20th, and I have an interview at 1 o'clock. And I'm sitting in the parking lot where I'm about to interview, and I'm as ready as I can be. And I'm going to go in there and give it hell and hope for the best, and I'll be back afterward.
Jennifer and Brian Barfield have been keeping audio diaries throughout the year to document their job search for NPR.
Well, hello again. I've just left my interview, and well, it was good, and they really liked me a lot.
After 2 years of searching, at times struggling to even get out of bed in the morning, Jennifer has a job. It's not permanent, and the pay is $20,000 a year less than her last job, but none of that matters. She's just glad to be working again. But if the Barfields have any hope of catching up on their bills, Brian needs a full-time job, too. And just as Jennifer is getting good news, it seems like all of Brian's leads have gone cold.
Mr. Hamels, Brian Barfield. I'm just making sure I didn't miss your call this week. I thought you said we'd get together for the interview. Just give me a call back when you can. Thanks.
What are you doing, honey?
Your fridge.
Oh. He's cleaning the fridge. Brian was making me laugh last night, saying he's now the house husband. And he is. He does the cleaning and the dishes and sometimes the cooking.
Brian may joke about it, but the idea that he isn't the breadwinner, that drives him crazy.
She's working, so every dollar she earns is one more under my nose that I didn't earn, you know, and I'm not contributing, and there's a lot of pressure.
So when the company where he works occasional weekends offered him a seasonal position just for late spring and summer, Brian jumped at it.
It's supposed to be for college kids, but I applied for it because I'm not doing anything else in the meantime. So I might as well earn some cash.
The seasonal pay is about half what regular employees get. Brian is hoping that he'll impress company managers enough to get hired on permanently. So now they're both working, but it's still not what most people would consider normal. Jennifer works 8 to 5, and Brian works overnight.
You know, we can still do whatever we want in the evenings. We still have dinner together. We can still go shopping. It's just when she goes to bed, I go to work, and when I go to bed, she goes to work.
They still have a date night on Fridays, and they still go for drives. For the first time in their marriage, the Barfields are able to focus on something other than finding a job, each other. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. The International Monetary Fund is looking for a new leader. The institution's former head, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, resigned last week after being charged with sexual assault in New York. One of the top candidates is also French, Christine Lagarde. That country's finance minister, who officially announced her candidacy for the IMF today. Eleanor Beardsley sends this profile.
Appointed by President Nicolas Sarkozy in 2007, Christine Lagarde is the first woman ever to head the economic affairs of a G8 economy. Though she got off to a shaky start in her relations with the French media, she came into her own during the world economic crisis. Greg Viscusi, a reporter with Bloomberg News, follows Lagarde in the European financial world.
You know, she spoke perfect English. She knew how things worked overseas. She's always quite pleasant to deal with. In French politics, she's one of the few people that doesn't always seek a political fight.
Rumor has it that when the crisis broke, U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson would take calls from Lagarde, but not other foreign officials. Her ease with American culture comes from her time spent studying and working in the U.S. She spent a year in a Baltimore high school and later served as a labor lawyer and partner in a Chicago law firm. Lagarde returned to France to become trade minister under former President Jacques Chirac. President George W. Bush called her one of the family. Forbes magazine ranked Lagarde the 17th most powerful woman in the world in 2009 as she battled the global economic crisis. During that same year, she made an appearance on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
Most of our banks were fine, but, you know, it happened that there was one which didn't do right, was losing money, and we had to just inject capital and put equity in the bank. And once you become the shareholder, I certainly, for one, said the management is out. They did a crappy job. They have to go.
I love it.
No matter his current situation, Strauss-Kahn is said to have done an excellent job as IMF chief. He is credited with increasing the strength and relevance of the institution as it steered nations away from bankruptcy and helped buttress the euro currency. Françoise Nicolas, a financial expert with the French Institute of International Relations, says Lagarde can fill Strauss-Kahn's shoes.
Christine Lagarde has precisely a number of the qualities that are needed to replace him. She has an international profile. She knows how to deal with Americans, which is extremely important for such a job.
These days, Lagarde is hounded by the press whenever she appears in public. One possible stumbling block to her candidacy is her questionable handling of a high-profile dispute involving a tycoon and a French bank in 2008. A French court will decide soon whether there should be a formal investigation. For now, Lagarde has the support of Britain, Germany, Italy, and the Netherlands. Europeans say it is important to keep the IMF post because of the ongoing sovereign debt crisis. Though the IMF has traditionally been held by a European and the World Bank by an American, there is pressure to change that. The leaders of Brazil, Mexico, and China say it is time to have a representative from an emerging market or a developing nation. Reporter Viscusi says the fact that Lagarde is a woman is good for the obvious reason, to make a clear break with the sex scandal. But he says there are other advantages, especially if Europe and America want to keep the status quo for now.
So by having a woman, it sort of goes part way. It's not someone from the developing world, but it's not someone from the old boys club either. So I think it might be a way sort of to make people swallow the pill of having yet another European.
The IMF is accepting candidates until June 10th. The institution says it will choose its next director by the end of June. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly, in for Steve Inskeep. It's a time of show votes on Capitol Hill. Senate Democrats last night forced their GOP colleagues to vote on a House Republican budget. As a result, most of those Republicans are now on record as backing a plan to privatize Medicare. Next week in the House, a similar show vote is planned. Republicans will ask lawmakers to raise the debt ceiling with no strings attached, a move that could put Democrats in a tight spot. NPR's David Wellna has the story.
When House Republicans approved the spending plan drawn up by Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan last month, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid made no move to bring it up for a vote. But that was before GOP House members went back to their districts and took a lot of heat from angry constituents for backing the plan, which would privatize Medicare a decade from now. Polls also show sizable majorities rejecting that plan. And when Democrat Kathy Hochul won a House seat in a special election in a solidly Republican district in upstate state New York this week. Democrats credited that upset victory to her Republican opponent's embrace of Paul Ryan's Medicare proposal. Last night, when Reid called for a vote on bringing up the House budget in the Senate, he zeroed in on Medicare.
The Republican plan to kill Medicare is a plan to make the rich richer and the sick sicker.
But the top Republican on the Budget Committee, Alabama's Jeff Sessions, said Democrats just don't get it.
They think they can scare people by saying we're going to end Medicare. And they're going to vote on it. And the vote in our Democratic politicians' mind is that we defend Medicare and all of you oppose Medicare. American people are getting too smart for that. I don't believe they're going to buy that path any longer.
For Republican Mike Johanns of Nebraska, it was simply campaign politics.
These votes, I guarantee, are all about political fodder for next year's election season.
Five Republicans, two of them up for re-election next year, broke ranks with their party and voted with Democrats to block the Ryan budget, 57-40. Alaska's Lisa Murkowski was one of those renegades.
The Medicare reform piece is not one that I'm 100% with. Maybe I'm looking for the perfect here, but anyway, I'm voting no.
Pointing to this week's victory in the New York House District, Senate Democratic Campaign Committee Chairwoman Patty Murray said it's clear the GOP Medicare plan is giving pause to a lot of other Republicans as well.
So I'm confident that Senate Democrats will be able to play offense in races across the country by remaining focused on the Republican effort to end Medicare in order to pay for an almost 30% tax rate reduction for the wealthiest Americans and big corporations.
Asked about the Senate Democrats putting his budget up for a vote before offering a plan of their own, House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan was dismissive.
It would be nice if they actually wrote a budget and tried to pass a budget. I think it's more political theater than anything.
Which is exactly what House Democrats are saying about the Republicans' plan to hold a vote next week on raising the debt ceiling without attaching any debt reduction measures that would make such a vote politically safer for both sides. Democrats have backed off earlier demands for a vote simply on raising the debt limit, which has already been reached. But House Republican Conference Chairman Jeb Hensarling says that vote's going ahead.
This is something that the Secretary of Treasury has requested. It's something that I think it's 100, perhaps 150 different House Democrats have requested. We don't believe that's the way to go. But I think it's important to let the president know that is not where the support of Congress is. So this will let him know that the votes aren't there and hopefully hasten negotiations.
New Jersey House Democrat Rob Andrews says Republicans are playing a very dangerous game with this vote.
Because what you're going to get next week is a headline that says U.S. House fails to raise debt ceiling. I don't know what global investors are going to make of that headline, but I don't think they should be reading it.
Will you vote to raise the debt ceiling?
I probably will.
That, too, is a vote destined to become next year's campaign fodder. David Wellna, NPR News, The Capitol.
LinkedIn became the first social networking company to sell shares to the public last week. The offering was wildly successful. Shares more than doubled in price the first day. The company, which had $15 million in profits last year, is now worth about $9 billion. Those kind of numbers have some wondering whether we're looking at the start of another tech bubble. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
The last time CNBC sounded this upbeat was over a decade ago.
LinkedIn IPO blowing the lid off the New York Stock Exchange this morning.
Back in early 2000, the Nasdaq was nearly twice where it is now. Investors poured big bucks into anything with a .com. Remember the sock puppet?
I'm a professional happy puppet thing, and it's my job to make animals happy. Pets.com, because pets can't drive.
Pets.com, like many others, failed to generate a profit. Investors pulled out in a huge rush, and it all came crashing down in early 2000. Investors retrenched. They started caring about profits again. Lee Simmons is an industry analyst at Hoover's, a company that tracks IPOs.
We have a lot of echoes of 1999.
This time, the enthusiasm is over social networking. Speculation is that Facebook, Groupon, and Twitter are mulling their own offerings. Simmons says there are plenty of risks for investors, most notably that users are fickle and could ditch these services as quickly as they signed up for them. But that may not be enough to scare investors. He says some people love bubbles.
Bubbles are fun. You know, they're around. They don't hurt initially when you run into them. They get bigger and bigger.
Simmons says venture capitalists, or VCs, are among those willing to fan the hot air.
This is really the first spark of hope that we've seen in the VC industry in a long, long time. And I guarantee you that there is not a single VC backer in this country who isn't thinking about how they're going to go to market as quickly as possible. These guys want to start making money again.
Michael Aronson is a venture capitalist who is, indeed, excited about making money again.
What was the biggest lesson you think you learned about bubbles from the 2000 bubble crash?
Sell when you get the opportunity.
That's it.
Because markets may turn against you.
Aronson got his chance to sell late last year. Diapers.com, which his firm funded, sold to Amazon for a little over $500 million. He was pleased with that deal until LinkedIn showing last week.
Diapers.com was on a path toward IPO, and right now I wish they had stayed on that path because the valuation probably would have been significantly higher.
Aronson, who taught at Wharton School of Business during the last tech boom, says there are significant differences between then and now. Now, companies can do a lot more without having millions of dollars in capital. Web access, computers, servers, and other basic infrastructure is so much cheaper. Also, startups aren't throwing money at Super Bowl ads like they used to. And like LinkedIn, companies these days have been around a few years, long enough to have a proven track record and some profits.
The companies that are going public now are the companies that are fairly large companies with, you know, real users, real customers, real revenues, multiple revenue sources.
Anyway, Aronson says it's wrong to think that just because some of those businesses didn't work out in the 1990s that they won't work now. Back then, we relied on clunky dial-up connections. Phones didn't come with high-speed data plans, so online shopping wasn't what it is now. It's funny, Aronson says. Just the other day, he reviewed a couple of business plans proposing to sell, of all things, pet food online. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.